Have you heard of the play cycle? What about democratic education? In this episode, we talk to Matilda Element from Pine Community School about the role of play in the lives of our children through the lens of the play cycle and how democratic education is a powerful way to amplify the voices of our children and to empower them. Welcome to Raising Wildlings, a podcast about parenting, alternative education, and stepping into the wilderness, however that looks, with your family.
Each week, we'll be interviewing experts that truly inspire us to answer your parenting and education questions. We'll also be sharing stories from some incredible families that took the leap and are taking the road less travelled.
We're your hosts, Vicky and Nikki from Wildlings Forest School. Pop in your headphones, settle in, and join us on this next adventure. This episode of the Raising Wildlings podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Fun Fables podcast. Fun Fables is a great little podcast for kids with stories like The Three Little Pigs, Jack and the Beanstalk, and The Gingerbread Man, retold in a fun, entertaining way. Just search Fun Fables Stories for Kids on your favourite podcast app or click the link in the show description. Welcome, welcome to the Raising Wildlings podcast. I'm your host today, Vicky Oliver. We've had so many exciting things happening back at Wildlings HQ, and alongside with the fact that we homeschool our children and just the natural happenings of our personal lives, it means that we really just needed a week to catch our breath. But we're back and we've had a very exciting week of interviews and conversations, and we can't wait to bring them all to your ears. So if you haven't already done so, do yourselves and us a favour by subscribe to the podcast on your platform of choice. You could also share the artwork so that we can spread our messages to more people that have the power to make positive changes in the lives of our children. Today, though, we are continuing to learn more about alternatives here in Australia when it comes to education. So I'm in conversation with Matilda Element. She's currently an educator, new school founder, as well as an ex-student of one of Brisbane's unique alternative schools, Pine Community School. Matilda has a particular interest in play, which she's going to tell us all about, storytelling and advocating for children's rights. And this all ties into her work at Pine, which is a democratic school. So I have a feeling this is not the last we are going to hear from her, as she has so much passionate knowledge and experience to share with us all. So let's dive right into this conversation with Matilda. Hi, Matilda. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today? Hi. Are you feeling that midterm slump at the moment?
I'm pretty good today. I'm having a day at home talking to you, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, because you work at Pine Community School.
Yes.
Which is described as an independent democratic community primary school.
Yes.
And I don't know that a lot of people actually understand democratic education. So can you give us a quick rundown on what that is and how Pine delivers that in an Australian context?
Certainly. There's a lot of democratic schools around the world, and it is an umbrella term, so we need to be really clear that it encounters a lot of different models under that umbrella. But schools who believe very strongly and are committed very strongly to a respectful relationship between children and adults in the space, an equal partnership between children and adults in the space, and children being very actively involved in the decisions that affect them, the things that they're learning about, and the way their space is operating, can be under that umbrella term of democratic education. So if you're a place that values children's voices, and gives them a say in any way, then you can consider yourself to be in that democratic umbrella, that you're a part of that democratic education family that looks very different models. Incorporate those elements, but it is an international term. It's a term that's used quite frequently in lots of international school contexts. In Australia, there's a number of schools that consider themselves to be using democratic education principles or operating in democratic ways. Pine wasn't originally founded as a democratic school. It was founded as a community primary school. So I'll probably unpack that a little bit first, if you like.
Yeah.
It was founded in 1983 by a bunch of parents who really wanted to be more involved in their children's education. They wanted to have more of a say. They wanted to be there. They wanted open door policies. And they wanted to have a lot of respect for the children and also a lot of play play was a huge part of what they were doing. There was a lot of early childhood teachers who were involved in that initial startup group, really fantastic early childhood teachers who are just wonderful people that we respect greatly. So there was a lot of those principles of play and projects and being parents being a real part of that community space that's set up Pine as a community school. And that continues to this day. It is an open door policy. It is parents are welcome anytime. Parents are very involved. Parents come in and offer workshops in skills that they're interested in, or they just hang out. They are a part of our community. Their little people are a part of their community. So it is a very multi-age space with a lot of from little people to big people and to teenagers who come back and visit. So it is, that is where we started. And then probably about 10 years into Pine's journey, the teachers who were working at the time discovered a lot of the principles of democratic education and said, well, actually, this is stuff that we do already that's very core to our philosophies, but how about we increase this by making sure that we've got practical, actionable sort of strategies that we do in the school. So that's when they started doing things like whole school meeting, where the kids come together and discuss issues that affect them and make the decisions about those issues, and class meetings and things followed from there, and lots of those practical tools that come from the democratic education movement. There's lots of different ways to do school meetings and whole school meetings. And we at the moment, and for probably at least 8 or 9 years, have been really passionate about consensus democracy, which is a model of democracy that says it's not majority rule, okay? So it's not the loudest voice wins. You can't come into the situation and say, oh, yeah, there's 8 of us who all totally think this and 4 of you think something else, so we're just going to do this anyway, even though this really affects you guys and you're really against it. That doesn't fly in a consensus democracy. You actually have to sit down and talk it out and consider everybody's needs until you get to a workable solution that everyone can live with. It may not be the solution that everyone says, this is the greatest solution of all time, but it's something that we can all agree to work on and live with for a while. And the people who are really against it often get to a point where they've modified it and they've had a say and they've had power in that situation. So they say, well, this solution isn't my solution, but I'm willing to give it a go for a predetermined period, maybe 2 weeks. And we'll revisit in 2 weeks and see how that's going. So that's a constant.
It's really amazing, because I think that there's a lot of adult-centered businesses and groups that could really benefit from those skill sets. So,
it's a fantastic skill set. And actually, it is consensus democracy, and also sometimes it's talked about in terms of sociocracy. So some of that writing and research is in that model as well. It is making its way into businesses, and it's making its way into homes and families. It's because I actually went to Pine as a student and have taught there for a number of years before I had my own family. My family is a democratic family. We do have lots of meetings where it's like, oh my gosh, we're going to have another meeting about bedtime. Okay, let's find a workable solution. But it is a great model for that, even though it does take time. It is more time consuming than just saying, no, bedtime is this, so everybody's going to bed and then this is, but hearing their needs and them, but crucially, hearing the adults' needs as well is important for children. And so that everyone in the space who's impacted is able to have a say, have a voice, and be heard, even if that doesn't fix things or solve things. It's a very powerful model. I find it very useful in my family, and it often can be that we don't come up with anything new, but we just all walk away feeling a bit better about hearing each other.
Feeling heard and at least having a say,
I
think is very, very powerful. We talk a lot about respectful relationships and respectful communication and making sure people feel heard. Mm. And when we talk to our parents too about that two-way communication, so you want to make sure that you're feeling heard, because I feel like that's a frustration for parents, but so much about children's voices. I have so many questions that will stem from that. The one thing that I also loved that you mentioned before was about how your community and your parents and the open door, but about having the little siblings, the tiny people coming in as well and being part of that community. I see so much value in having that broad spectrum of diversity.
Oh, absolutely. Look, multi-age is real. It's real life, isn't it? It's authentic. Mm. It's how It's how we want our children to grow up. We want them to know that there's value in different people and different ages, yeah. and that they can meet, be friends with someone who's 5 years older than them or 2 years younger than them, or that they can receive interesting information and experiences. We have actually had a really lovely multi-age play happening yesterday, because my kids at the moment, I teach the little people, so they're sort of mm-hmm. 5 and 6 and 7. A whole group of them are really into dragon play. They really love being dragon. They're just super dragon. Familiar. Dragon world. Dragons always are big, because, you know, you get to be a little person and be really powerful. But we had a little sister who was really wanting to be a part of that play. She was 3, and it was a really beautiful example of multi-aging, because they were really wanting to be very nurturing and include her and do that really nurturing, like take care of the baby dragon egg, at the same time as developing these skills in noticing that she actually wanted to be really powerful. She wanted to be the powerful dragon, not the baby dragon. And so them being able to notice that in the play situation and go, oh, yes, we need your fire to cook the meat, because you're the powerful flame dragon. And, can you go deep into the forest even though it's dangerous and get us some more food? So they were really able to see, to fulfill their own needs to nurture a little person, but also to see that little person needed to feel powerful as well.
Isn't
so that's really, really nice multi-aging. And I think it happened because they've, and these are sort of 5 and 6 year olds, but they get those same experiences from the bigger kids in the space, the 10 and 12 year olds and the 11 year olds and the 7 year olds, you know, that they are having these multi-age experiences all the time.
And it's such a powerful thing. I also feel so honoured to be able to sit back and watch that. And it's unlike, I know with our homeschooling community, even yesterday at our co-op, and just watching this immense game going on with children ranging from, you know, like, as you said, the age of 3 all the way up to the ages of, say, 12. And it's unlike anything I ever saw working in traditional schools. So there's something very, very special about that.
I would also argue, though, that we are very privileged to be able to see it and to participate in it and to create the environments and the cultures that support it. However, I would also say that there is a universality to it, that taking away some of those structures that don't allow it to exist, it play and multi-age play and multi-aging happen very naturally and universally across cultures and across countries.
Yes.
So it's not something we actually need to do too much to make happen.
No.
It's there in children. They're ready for those
That's
experiences
right.
quite easily.
It's the adults that need to remove the barriers.
Yeah, and we need to learn a lot of skills that maybe sometimes we didn't have. So we have to work a lot on what we need for ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Now we've mentioned a little bit about play. So do you want to talk about the role of play in children's lives, and then our role as adults?
Yes, that's something I'm really passionate about. Early childhood teacher. I'm a very passionate early childhood teacher. I love early childhood. It's a great space because of that really strong philosophies of play and projects and learning that comes emergently from children. And it's something that we do really value across the spectrum at Pine, that our kids continue to be involved in play-based learning and project-based learning, even when their play looks very different when they're 11 or 12. It's fantastic, but it's very different to the play of 4 and 5 year olds. Including that multi-age play. But the role of adults in play, I was actually wanted to introduce the play cycle to parents if they hadn't come across it, because I think it's just a beautiful model and I just love it so much to pieces. So I always
want to
share it. The play cycle was invented by Gordon Storick and Perry Else, who were actually play workers. So they were theorists who researched about play, read about play, but they weren't teachers. They weren't looking at it from a teacher perspective. More of a biological perspective, neurobiological, evolutionary perspective. And their cycle is a very universal cycle that looks at play across cultures and across ages. And it's really beautiful and really simple, and yet it gives us so much about our roles as adults. So it's all play starts with a drive, an impulse to play. They call this phase, the first phase, metalooding, which is just a delightful word. Just sort of, I'm not bored. I'm just sitting around metalooding. You know, what am I going to do? Thinking about
great word,
so fantastic. So the drive comes to play, to be involved, to be engaged, and it can be an unconscious drive or a conscious drive. What am I going to do? I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Or just oh, there's a stick. Oh, that's really interesting. The drive is followed by the cue. So the cue might be an object like a stick. Oh, there's a stick, there's a fence. I'm going to grab it. I'm going to bang some music out. That's going to be great. It might be a signal, a verbal signal. Will you play with me? What's a good example from school? The kids at school are really into cops and robbers, so sometimes you'll just hear someone yelling, cops and robbers on the fort, cops and robbers on the fort, which is a cue to play cops and robbers, and that's the place. If you want to be in that game, you get to that spot. So the cue is the invitation, the signal to play. So it can come from another person, it can come from the object, it can come from the environment. There might be some really interesting loose parts that make you think, oh, yes, I'd like to do something with that. Mm-hmm. That happens. The cue happens and then a return happens. Something happens with the person or the object and there's a response to that play cue. And there's a back and forth that bounces in there and it can be between kids and kids, between adults and kids, between kids and objects or kids and environment. If that sort of settles, that cue and response pattern, then play is established and that has a frame around it. Play is actually, it's very important to probably articulate at this point, it is driven by children. Yeah. If it's driven by adults, it can be playful and it can be totally playful and wonderful and rich. Our rich learning, rich everything, but if it's driven by adults, it's actually not technically play. If you've put the cue out there and said, right, this is this cool activity, it's great, but it's not play. It's got to be child-driven to be play. So the kids create a frame around their play, and the frame can actually be a physical frame. Oh, we're making a cubby. This is the actual frame. There's sticks here. There's a mat here. There's a literal frame sometimes around, or it can actually be an emotional frame. It can be, this is a really exciting chasing game where I'm feeling a little bit risky and a little bit scared, but it's exciting and that's the feeling that I want from my game, and the people in the game are sharing that emotional frame. It can be a narrative frame, like a story. This is a story of a dragon story, and we're all being dragons, except if we're being dragon hunters or dragon healers, but we're not being superheroes because our frame, our narrative frame, is a really focused in that dragon world. So it can be a physical frame, an emotional frame, a narrative frame, and you can slide in and out of those things.
Yeah.
Frames can take ages to establish. It can be a lot of negotiation where kids are actually arguing for a while about how the frame, or can happen quite instantly, like in an instant the frame is established and the play is happening and it's wonderful. And then you have flow. As you say, it's wonderful to observe. Sometimes when you're observing, if you have the beautiful skills and experience to be observing, to put this play frame over the top of it and you're like, oh, yep, frame's established, cool, now they're in flow. Flow is good stuff. We love flow. Flow is when the frame's established, everything's going well, cues and returns are happening, bouncing back between people, it's all looking pretty exciting, there's a lot of rich stuff going on, there's often lots of rich talk, it's lots of rich learning, it's a really exciting place when flow is happening. And then there's this amazing other word. So it starts with this beautiful metaluding and it ends with annihilation. You've got to love that word being in there.
That is a great word to describe.
It's just so good. And it just, when the natural end of play is annihilation. And it's really interesting when you watch kids and you think this is going really well, right? You think this is flowing really well. And suddenly they've all gone and everybody's doing something else. And you're like, whoa, what happened there? I missed that. I thought that was still continuing, but now something else is happening. And it can just be that kids naturally annihilate play when they get to the point where they've played it out. They don't have any more things that they need to get from this play. They've totally soaked as much as they can out of this experience and they're ready for a new experience. They're metalooting again and they're off somewhere else or they've seen something else. It's a really beautiful enrichment. It happens in that natural way and it can be really surprising to adults the point at which it annihilates. We also as adults do annihilate their play quite
often. Of course, that was my first thought, annihilation. Really, I thought, that's usually when they're being called in from an adult.
Yeah, and they actually call that in the play cycle, which I just also love, adulteration, which is when adults interfere with the play in a way that actually wrecks the frame. The play workers who invented this cycle talk a lot about the role of adults in play, and I think we can get a lot as parents, as teachers, as people involved with children from those different roles, because we do actually have roles to play, and they are varying roles and they can be quite positive roles. They talked about the adults as a resource for play. So, oh, you guys are building a bridge. I really love that. Is there anything else you need? oh, you need a rope. Okay, cool. I'll get you rope. That's a really simple level of adult resourcing play. You can be invited into play by kids offering you a cue. And you can be invited in varying roles, from a really temporary role, like help us while we're in this setting up the frame stage, but then know it's time to retreat and let that play out. Lots of kids, when they're particularly young, would really often invite a very medial temporary role. And it's really important, if you are jumping into that role, to be really aware of that role being a low status character in the play. If it's a narrative play, you're not the king, you're the servant, you know?
Yeah.
So you're not controlling the play. You're stepping back, stepping back, stepping back, to the point where those kids can play on without you.
That's difficult for some parents. I know we have conversations with them a lot of around, and particularly people have stepped in as a parent for the first time and they've got one child and can sometimes find it hard to know their role in play because sometimes they're too involved and then they get to a point where they feel like their child can't play without them.
Mm. There is also that complex play role where you actually are a player in the play, and that can be invited, and that can be that you are of equal status and you're playing equally, and it's actually not used as often in the play cycle stuff, but we do see it a lot in parent play and we do see it a lot in I probably enter into play in a complex role quite often, but I try and be really low status and I try and keep it so that the kids have got their own thing. But I think it is okay to be in that role sometimes, as long as you're aware of how often you're in that role as the complex player, and also knowing that parenting is a long-term journey, isn't it? It really is.
It is.
And so sometimes while you might be feeling really upset or worried that, they can't play without me, I would say don't worry. They will get there, you know.
Yeah.
You might be their best player when they are 3 and 4 and 5, but then they will be 10 and you'll be like, hey, I see you doing some cool play over there. Okay, I'm not a part of that, but I'm really glad that you can do that now. Nothing lasts forever. It is temporary, but yes, knowing as parents when to step back. And I think the play workers movement would tell us very much step back more, step back as often as possible, step back more and more and more. And if you are stepping in, make sure that you are invited to step in.
Yeah.
Make sure that that invitation and that cue is actually coming from them and not from you.
Yes.
Not from you being scared of them metaluding, you know, being scared, oh, no, they're bored, they're metaluding. I actually think metaluding is a great way. So that we can get rid of that whole board, which is a horrible word.
I was just going to say, you know, what a great way to transfer. Like, it's always good to just swap words out. Yeah, totally.
And also that, I guess that also the other role, I think, which I don't think we mentioned, because we're resourcing play, we're being invited temporarily, we're sometimes in a complex role but trying to stay low status, but also we're sometimes called in to be the witness, to do the integrity role, to work out, help conflict resolution, to help work out disputed or conflicting frames, to kind of help in that way.
Yeah.
And also what we see probably in schools more than in families is the role of the adult helping kids to get good at entering play.
Yeah.
To learn how to get into a game without wrecking the frame for the other kids, because often it's not that the other kids are being mean and wanting them included. It's just that you want to play superheroes and they're playing posties, and you can't just come in and be superheroes. You've got to find a way be superhero posties, you know.
It's a lot about coaching them through the emotions and how to approach each other.
And I think it's just a work in progress. We just get better and better at the things that we want to get better at and that we need to get better at, using the, you know, the MVC, the respectful language, active listening, but also teaching our kids how it works. When some kids, we actually do need to teach them how play works, to teach them to step back and observe what other kids are doing and look for ways in, look for entry points in, look for what it looks like when somebody invites you into play, offers you a cue. It's often non-verbal too,
absolutely,
so that they're not missing their cues that are happening and things like that.
It's very intricate sometimes.
Yeah, and it's so it seems like this deceptively simple. Yeah, there's cues, returns, there's a frame, there's flow, and then it all blows up. And how lovely! but it actually, there's so much complicated and interesting stuff going on in there. So I really like that model. I came across
it
about 8 years ago, and I thought, oh, this is really great.
I think it's parent, brilliant too, because the wordplay, because it seems so trivial. Like play just seems like a trivial idea to people, and we starting to understand and get the message across that it is a more complex process, and the reason we need to value it so much is because when we have that understanding, we can then assign a greater value than what perhaps has been assigned to it in the past.
Oh, absolutely. And I think probably that is happening more, having to happen more in schools and outside school hours, care centres and things, probably because of the way our society is. You know, there's not as many opportunities for kids to have big free-ranging outdoor play with multi-age peers as they used to. So we're taking more of that role into play groups and nature schools and forest schools. And so we're making the spaces to fulfil these very intense evolutionary neurobiological needs to play that children and adults have. And we're trying to do that in ways that are respectful of what they're into and what their interests are.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree. I just want to talk quickly about advocating for children's voices, something that we are pretty passionate about at Wildlings. Do you have some suggestions on how we can support families and schools to foster and promote a child's right to be engaged in decisions that affect them?
That's a very big question. I think it starts with parents particularly recognising that children are people too. So to quote Louise Porter's fabulous book title, children are people. They're not a secondary class, you know, there's adults and children, that we are all have the same human needs, that to be heard and to be listened to, that children have really great ideas. And it actually is very empowering as a parent and as a teacher to not have to have all the answers to all the problems in your family or in your schoolroom, to say, this is a problem, how can we solve it together, and to hear the solutions that are coming from the people who are involved. They may not be your solutions, and sometimes they are crazy solutions, but giving them a go or giving them a voice can lead to really beautiful things. It can lead to you finding new ways through problems, and even it can just lead to that understanding of hearing each other. I would say that it's very hard to be a parent or a teacher who has all the answers. It's very draining, especially if you don't have a network and a community around you who is supporting you. To have all of that stuff coming from you is very draining and exhausting. So it can be empowering for you as an adult to say, I don't have to have all the answers. I don't have to solve all the problems. I can offer my perspective and I can hear other perspectives, and somehow through that we will come up with some ideas and some consensus. I think sometimes people are very scared of that process, and that's natural because it's different. But I think if we remind ourselves that actually we are empowering ourselves as well.
Yeah.
It's not just about, oh, I'm going to give kids all this power and then I'm going to be, you know, asked to do all these things and they're going to want lollies for breakfast. And actually, no, it's about taking the pressure off you being the person who has to say, no, eat your breakfast and brush your teeth.
Yeah.
And these are all important things. But hearing, oh, okay, you find that hard to do that because you want to do these things. How can we get what we all need? How can we find a solution that works for all of us?
I think I say that quite a fair bit in my family. How do we get, you know, what's the solution so that we can all get what we need or as close to as we can?
Yeah.
And just even things like that can be so powerful.
Yeah. And knowing that, you know, it's a long-term process.
It is.
Growing it takes time, whether it's parenting or teaching. You want them to be confident communicators. You want them to be able to confidently communicate what they want and what they need in a respectful way. And to be able to disagree respectfully is an important skill. And to be able to solve a conflict with another person respectfully is an important skill.
Yeah.
And these are the things that we really value in democratic education, and that would really kids who go through Pine across the board are very different. They have very different interests. They come from we've got a very diverse community with very different families who have lots of different values, lots of different backgrounds. But the the commonality is that they have a really strong involvement in their children and a strong engagement in their families. And also, yeah. and the commonality that we see at the other end, these very different children who go on to very different pathways have a very strong sense of who they are and are very good communicators. They are very confident at asking for help when they need help. Generally, they go to high school and high school teachers are like, oh, we absolutely love these kids, because they say, oh, I'm really struggling with this. Can I get some help? And people go, oh, wow. They ask for what they need. And they're also very used to adults being respectful of them and having a good mutual friendship relationship where they're – so they are very willing to see those teachers as humans too, not necessarily perfect people, but humans. And so they have a lot of success in their relationships with adults because they have a very
which is so important.
Really nice relationship.
Yeah, imagine what the world would be like if every child had a start like that to be able to communicate.
Well, parenting for a peaceful world, hey?
Exactly. So, oh, another book title.
Yeah, it's all about books. It's always is.
Oh, all about books. Well, I could literally keep talking to you for a very long time, but I am mindful of the time. So I'm just –
And your daughter needs you. You need to go and help her. She's meddling right now.
She wants me to put the music on so she can dance in the lounge room, which I think is very important for me.
Super important. That's the most important right now. Show her how to do that.
It is. I'm going to ask you just three really quick questions to wrap up the interview. So the first one we always ask talking about books. At the moment, your favourite book?
That is such a hard one because I absolutely love books and reading, and I'm always reading a million things. I will probably give you two. Yeah. Number one, because it's about parenting, I will do The Opposite of Worry by Dr. Lawrence Cohen, who wrote Playful Parenting. So if you have children who are slightly anxious or slightly sensitive or prone to worry, this is the book for you.
I have lots of people who would be interested in that.
Oh, look, it's been such a good book for our family because I do have anxious and sensitive little people. Mm. And I've read lots of books about anxiety, and this is the best because it is practical and it is playful, and it has like a million, it's a very short read, but has lots of really great strategies. So there's something in there for everyone to find that they can take away. And I've gone back to it over the years as my kids have changed and grown. Yeah. I have a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And at various stages, I've gone back to that book and found new things that I can go, oh, this is something that I can integrate into our lives that will actually help us. So, yes, Opposite of Worry, Dr. Lawrence Cohen, who also wrote Playful Parenting, which is another
book. I've read Playful Parenting a long time ago.
Opposite of Worry is the one for me.
Yep.
And I just read last night, I finished reading Everything is Figureoutable by Marie Folio, which is a really cool book about going after your goals and your dreams and figuring out any problem in the world, but it's really got a lot of really practical stuff. So I really enjoyed that one too. And that's just a general cool book that I'm really enjoying.
I always love book recommendations. I mean, I have a stack on my high, but I can always add more. The next question I'd love your opinion on is, if you could just change one thing in the education system, what would that be?
Oh, that's a horrible question. Okay, can I clarify by saying first, the education system is actually got some amazing stuff happening. There are amazing stuff happening across a broad spectrum of schools. I have such a deep, deep respect for teachers in general. Teachers are phenomenal people.
They are.
So the number one thing I would do to change, I would give more power to teachers and less power to the structures above teachers, the bureaucracy and the hierarchy, who often control and corral what teachers are allowed to do in their own classrooms. I would take us back to a more 1980s, 1990s style situation where teachers were respected as professionals and could differentiate the curriculum depending on what the kids were into, and that was okay. Whereas in we've gone a long way down the path where teachers are deprofessionalized and told to do this unit followed by this unit followed by this unit and can't make the decisions that they need.
That's right. And then it makes them more disenfranchised and less likely to be the best versions of themselves.
True. Sorry to cut you off just there, but they don't learn the skills they need to be good teachers, which means they need to learn to fail. They need to make mistakes and go, oh, that didn't work. What could I do differently?
Yeah.
But we're so scared of teachers making mistakes that we're prescribing everything that they do in the classroom, and so we're not letting them become really interesting teachers, and we're not letting the kids engage with really interesting curriculum because we're telling them what they have to do every minute. So I would put more power back in the hands of teachers who are trained to be really amazing people and just let them fly.
Brilliant. And our last question is, where do you go to unwind and relax after a hard day? Like, where's your go-to place to ground yourself?
I would probably say the couch with a book and my boys. We'd like to just snuggle and read together. Also outside going for walks and bike rides and swimming. Absolutely love to go for a swim. Mm. But on a general, more daily routine basis, it would be, let's just take 20 minutes to read some cool picture books or some chapter books and just snuggle and just be relaxed and calm for a little bit.
Honestly, there's so many more questions. I'm sure we will talk again at some stage in the future because I think there's so many things that you touched on that we'd love to go a lot deeper with.
Oh, I'm happy to talk at any time.
But thank you so much for sharing your insights about democratic schools and also about the play cycle. I found that really fascinating. So we hope to
talk
to
you again soon. Thank you. Have a really nice time dancing.
I will. Thank you so much. I feel like we've only just scratched the surface of democratic education and the role of play, and I had so many other questions, so stay tuned as we plan to have Matilda on the show again to go a bit deeper. We did talk a little bit about how we communicate with children, and on that note, today is the last day that you can register for our intake of our Respectful Communication online course. Now, this is a self-paced course. It's a combination of recorded videos, reflection prompts, and some printable resources that can help you if you'd like to make some changes in the way that you connect with the children in your lives. So if you found yourself in a bit of a cycle of reward and punishment, perhaps yelling a little bit too much for your liking or for your children's liking, then this is the course for you because we'll give you some introductory tools to help change the way you communicate with your children, to help make sure that we understand that respectful relationship that we really do want to have with them. So to register, you need to head to our website, wildlingsforestschool.com/online courses. And as I said, today is the last day. We won't be opening this course again until 2021. Next week, Nikki and I will be chatting about the ways in which we have fostered independence in our own children. And gosh knows when you work from home and spend as much time with your children as we do, it is a saving grace for both us as parents, but also for them in inspiring some confidence and self-sufficiency. So stay tuned. And as always, we love doing this journey with you. So until next time, stay wild.